Hello, this is Ross Friedman reading the New York Times Book Review. I'm going to be reading from the short list, and the theme of the short list is Squabbling Families in Fiction by Jennifer Reese. She is the reviewer of these three novels here. The first one is titled Little Faith by Nicholas Butler. 318 pages, published by Echo Harper Collins, $26.99. The protagonist of Butler's quiet novel counts himself a man pretty much satisfied with his life. In his mid-60s, Lyle Hovde still lives in the small Wisconsin town where he grew up, strolling through the cemetery, gazing at the graves of people he once knew. He feels a deep and abiding unity and evenness, as if the volume in his life were suddenly dimmed down. Humble and contemplative, he enjoys his work, tending an apple orchard, the company of a few old friends, and a happy marriage. His daughter, Shyla, a single mother, has come home to raise her son, Isaac, and Lyle dotes on the five-year-old. Oh, he loved the boy, and that was all there was to it. His is a heart waiting to be broken, and broken it will be. Although he still attends the local Lutheran church for the ritual and community, Lyle stopped believing in God years ago when his infant son died. A fissure opens between Lyle and Shyla as she becomes increasingly devout, quoting scripture, periodically dropping to her knees in prayer, and frequenting sketchy startup churches in strip malls. The fissure widens when she becomes romantically involved with Stephen, a handsome and charismatic young pastor, who preaches to a raucous congregation in an old movie theater, prowling the aisles like a panther. Stephen convinces Shyla that little Isaac is a healer capable of curing diseases with the laying on of hands, and he convinces Lyle that his daughter and grandson have fallen into the clutches of a dangerous confidence man. When Lyle won't embrace Stephen's fiery brand of Christianity, Shylock cuts off his contact with Isaac, precipitating a series of increasingly dire crises. With its focus on spirituality and reverence for the joys of everyday life, Little Faith calls to mind Mary Lynn Robinson's Gilead, although Butler can't match Robinson's stately prose and evocations of inner grace. The second book reviewed in this short list of Squabbling Families and Fictions is titled White Elephant by Julie Langsdorff. 313 pages, published by Echo Harper Collins, $26.99. Langsdorff announces what her novel will be about, marriage and real estate, in its jaunty opening lines. Allison Miller lay in bed in the dim light of early morning, thinking about sex. It was the hammering on the new house being built next door that was responsible, the rhythmic pound, pound. The pounding is the work of Nick Cox, a real estate developer who has already built himself a tastelessly huge house on Dunlop Place, a block of tastefully small bungalows, and is in the process of building another. The Miller house is sandwiched between the monoliths. Allison's husband, Ted, is lying in bed next door, but he is too irate about the new construction to think about sex, let alone have it. Allison can't remember the last time she and Ted made love, although she loathes Nick Cox's gaudy construction projects. Allison's thoughts about the man have taken a carnal turn. The Millers aren't the only couple on Tunlaw Place with marital and real estate problems. Suzanne and Grant move into a home that is too small for their growing family. Suzanne, serious and driven, thinks of Grant as her Eliza Doolittle and has tried to transform him into the husband she wants, persuading him to stop blow-drying his hair and dress more Brooks Brothers and less JCPenney. Alas, the makeover hasn't fully taken. Grant won't stop smoking weed or texting his unambitious high school friends. Moreover, he doesn't really understand why everyone is so down on Nick Cox and his gigantic houses. Grant secretly digs the man's McMansion. Everything was padded. Everything was shiny and enormous. Grant wanted to leap onto the sectional leather sofa in the media room like a kid jumping into a pile of leaves. And really, who wouldn't? While skewering its vacuity and vulgarity, Langsdorff captures the sensuous allure of confident, over-the-top American consumerism. Nick Cox is uncomplicated and viral. His houses are appalling, but comfortable. Like Tom Perrotta's Little Children and Maria Semple's Where'd You Go, Bernadette, White Elephant exposes middle-class domestic malaise with a light comedic touch. The third book in the short list of Squabbling Families in Fiction is titled A Weekend in New York by Benjamin Markovitz, 346 pages, Faber and Faber Publishers, $24. The Essingers are one of those big talky families that seem to generate their own weather system whenever the far-flung members get together. In the opening chapters, various Essingers, aging parents in from Texas, four grown siblings, sundry grandchildren have begun to gather in New York City to watch the younger Essinger son, Paul, compete in the U.S. Open. As Markovitz's characters navigate a long weekend of sometimes tetchy togetherness, he moves among their inner worlds so deftly that you barely notice that you've made the transition from mother to daughter or father to son. The family itself is the central character, a single complicated organism. What happens over the course of the weekend in New York? Bickering, babka muffins, house hunting, covenants, gin and tonics, a jog in Central Park, judgment. The patriarch Bill visits his ailing sister in Yonkers near the home where they grew up and remembers why he has loved living in Austin. As an escape from all that, from the narrowness of his childhood, from the two sets of plates and the Friday night dinners, from the Hebrew you could speak but not really understand. Meanwhile, his wife Liesl, an author, endures a demeaning interview with an unprofessional reporter who has misunderstood her book and sticks her with the taxi fare. Jean, the youngest Essinger, confesses that she has begun an affair with a married colleague back in London, while her older sister Susie announces that she is pregnant with her third child. Alone with her thoughts and overwhelmed by her family, Susie reflects wistfully on her decision to have another baby. Kids give you a few years of protection from everything else, including your own family, your own childhood, but unless you keep making new ones, the protection runs out. There's not a lot of high drama in the novel. The characters' cool and sometimes startling insights into their own behavior are pleasure enough. The next shortlist theme is titled The CIA, and the reviewer is Jeff Stein. And the first book reviewed is titled Black Sight, The CIA in the Post-9/11 World by Philip Mudd, 247 pages, Liver Wright Publisher, $27.95. A few years after the attacks of 9/11, a manager of the Central Intelligence Agency's covert interrogation program posted a warning placard in his office. There are no secrets, it said. Sure enough, details on the agency's global necklace of covert holding cells and interrogations leaked, culminating in a controversial report by Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee that judged the program to be grounded in torture and largely ineffective. Not only that, it accused agency officials of lying about its results. Supporters of the program griped that the committee hadn't interviewed its managers. Now comes Mudd, a highly regarded senior former CIA and FBI counterterrorism official, with his own and other insiders' accounts of the program, from its helter-skelter inception to its ignominious end. This is a book about Washington process and bureaucracy, for sure, but with the added heft of dozens of first-hand accounts of what it was like to ride the tiger into the gates of hell. Some senior officials talk about memories of feeling that they had little choice but to start or continue the program, with President George W. Bush urging them to do whatever it took within the law to save American lives, Mudd writes. Alas, almost none of the participants, even those who've previously spoken publicly to defend the program, are on the record here, leaving accountability for its excesses elusive. From the start, the interrogation program had trouble written all over it. One of the CIA's lawyers remembered thinking that's about the only thing everyone can agree on. The second book in the short list of the theme, the CIA, is titled The Targeter, My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House by Nada Bakos with David Coburn, or Davin Coburn. 354 pages, published by Little Brown, $29. Early on in her bracing memoir of life and death in the CIA, Bakos hints at a childhood like that of Clarice Starling in The Silence of the Lambs. As a child in Montana cattle country, she grew attached to orphaned calves, which she'd later see funneled into a factory chute, mooing in terror until the moment some guy ended their brief lives by slamming a bolt to their skulls. Joining the CIA in 1999, Bakos turned her fury on terrorists, in particular Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a demented Jordanian criminal who had launched a vicious campaign of bombings and beheadings in the name of Islamic Jihad. When she tracks him down in a safe house north of Baghdad in June 2006, she looked forward to granting him the honor of martyrdom. In the end, Zaqawi's death didn't mean much, she writes. The 2007 troop surge into Iraq that rounded up thousands more suspected militants served mostly to turn prisons into terrorist universities. A quintessential example of the way a superficial tactical advance could lead to larger strategic failure. Baycus ended up haunted by her own failures as well. By 2010, she had had enough. Back home, she struggled with bad memories and stress. She also wore battle scars from a patriarchy of freewheeling men who had lorded over and sometimes preyed upon the bright young women who flocked to the CIA in the wake of 9/11. Now, in the era of the Me Too movement, this remarkable memoir arrives as another astonishing story of wartime valor. The third book in the short list of the theme, the CIA, is titled The Moscow Rules, The Secret of CIA Tactics That Helped America Win the Cold War by Antonio J. Mendez and Jonna Mendez with Matt Boglio, 238 pages, published by Public Affairs, $28. Aficionados of CIA history may know that a few of its leading lights were avid fans of magic. Back in the day, some operatives bested one another with card and coin tricks. It was the spook's version of charades. Tony Mendez, the CIA's top disguise artist for many years, who died in January, took magic out of the living rooms and into the streets of Moscow. And in this memoir of arcane CIA skullduggery, Mendez and his wife, who would eventually run the unit, demonstrate what a serious business it was. Every time CIA operatives left the Moscow embassy with the KGB agent in tow, they risked the lives of their Russian informants. They had to shake their tails. But how? And to my mind, Mendez reached the apex of his tricks with a contraption that could change an agent's look from a typical briefcase-toting American diplomat to a Russian babushka schlepping a cart. This within 45 seconds while walking down a sidewalk. Now that's magic. But why give away the secrets now? Because the CIA traitor, Aldrich Ames, spilled the bag of tricks to the Russians way back in 1985. Undoubtedly, it's a tougher game now, with the ubiquity of facial recognition software. All seriousness aside, the Moscow Rules is devilishly fun, even if you've heard some of the stories before. And the fourth book in the shortlist theme of the CIA is titled Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins by Annie Jacobson, 544 pages, published by Little Brown, $30. If you're the kind of person who thinks unleashing a few more machine gun wielding Rambos on the Middle East will solve America's problems, you'll love Jacobson's unbelievable tales of paramilitary daring do. If, on the other hand, you're a discerning reader who likes your nonfiction, well, nonfiction, you'll soon cast aside her latest sensationalist work. Her previous subjects were Nazi scientists, UFOs, paranormal scientists, and other conspiracy-laden topics. Now she turns her attention to covert ops and assassinations. Jacobson hangs her colorful stories of complex individuals working in treacherous environments populated by killers, connivers, and saboteurs on the emotions of Billy Waugh, a 90-year-old former CIA paramilitary officer who seems to have cut quite a swashbuckling path through the back alleys, as they say, of half the world. Unfortunately, no sooner do you get caught up in the adventures than you start tripping over long-ago debunked legends or factual errors, most of them avoidable. There are too many to cite here, but when she misidentifies the Navy hero and future President John F. Kennedy as a young lieutenant colonel during World War II, serious doubts creep in. Additional simple errors pop up in her treatments of a case I devoted a book to about Green Berets who were prosecuted for murdering one of their own agents in Vietnam. She embellishes other previously well-documented events with garish, doubtful details, and so on and on. Otherwise, it's a great beach book. The next short list theme is Stories by Helen Ellis. And the first book is titled That Time I Loved You by Carrie Ann Luing. 215 pages, published by Liver Wright, $24.95. All but the last story title in Lewing's new collection could be a clue in a winner's circle category on Dick Clark's The $25,000 Pyramid, Grass, Flowers, Fences, Things You Find in a Neighborhood. It's 1979, and in a grass-is-always-greener community, parents are killing themselves. A softball coach blows his head off in his basement. A housewife guzzles bleach in her garage. A stay-at-home mom hangs herself in her bathroom, and a drunk drinks himself to death on his couch. And there's a thief. Someone has stolen clothespin, scissors, a napkin ring, and a garden spade. What the heck is happening behind closed doors? Well, let me tell you, a lot. Each Link story has a secret. Yes, there's an affair, but what's going on with Grandma's wigs? Why doesn't that teenager want to go to her uncle's house? That lady is stress-eating. What? Hold the rotary phone. Can those primroses talk? In my favorite story, Treasure, the neighborhood wives discovered that their matriarch has been doing more than bedazzle in her hobby room. But here's the joyful surprise. What she feared would make her husband leave her makes her husband love her more. This book is about love between men and women, between parents and children, but most of all, it's about the look of fresh starts. Mixed in with the Farrah Fawcett look-alike neighbors, the subdivision is populated by immigrants. For their first-generation families, success is a garden, good grades, and a top-of-the-line Hoover. Casseroles are a cure-all. Lemon Pledge is an aphrodisiac. Privacy is the greatest luxury, but through picture windows, everybody spies. As if channeled by Gladys Kravitz and Charlie's Angels, Leung's stories read like the juiciest verified gossip. The next book in the short list of the themed stories is titled Sing to It by Amy Hempel. 149 pages, published by Scribner, $25. Hempel writes beautifully here about terrible things, death row dogs and depression, miscarriage, murder, molestation, and Mariah Carey. These are great stories about good dogs and bad apples. A poodle is a comfort, a retriever is a savior, and in Moonbow, a pet is reincarnated as a small, playful backyard brown bear after he was put down because he bit that awful delivery man who had it coming. There are a lot of awful men in this book. They turn up uninvited. They break in. They threaten lives with knives. They bury secrets in gardens, and then they offer their tainted fruit like a treat. So how does a woman survive her poisoned decisions? Hempel answers with Cloudland. You move, try Florida. You watch out for snakes. You get a new job, something simple. Care for the elderly. You live alone and do penance in a rundown house. You tolerate aggressive neighbors. You subscribe to catalogs that haunt you. The daydream about a family that you will never have on a boat on a lake without flies, mosquitoes, sunburn, or seasickness. Or you try for revenge. In my favorite story, Greed, a woman spies on her husband who is having an affair with a much older married woman. How much older? She's been married 40 years, looks like his mother, has work done, and wears low heels and gives him photos of herself dressed in an old-fashioned bathing suit. The narrator's husband is a serial adulterer, but Mrs. Greed is the first lover he will not give up. So the narrator, a children's speech therapist, hires a hit on the well-preserved old bag by thuggish teenagers who needed money. This touch with the stutter is why I love Hempel's working. With one word, she makes a judgment about every character involved, and no matter how harsh that word, I'm compelled to take her side. And the third book in the theme of shortlist theme of stories is titled Aerialist by Mark Meyer. 290 pages, published by Bloomsbury, $26. Meyer's book is set up like a circus at which the most relatable performer is a serial killer, clown. In The Clown, a middle-aged divorced man takes pride in the work. As a real estate agent, he wears a blazer and slacks and pairs the perfect property with the perfect couple. As a murderer, he wears a bruised strawberry wig made of real hair and porcelain-filled teeth and fantasizes about chemically flaying or smothering a woman or a victim with his own scalp. But like any man who's good at his job, he knows who he is, a clown with a knife. And as in any good love story, he finds a woman who will let him be himself, a clown with a knife. But it's frightfully romantic. In the rest of the stories, characters struggle to connect, and what's scary are the regular people. A girl befriends the surviving half of a pair of Siamese twins once joined at the brain like cookies baked together. But it's more disturbed. Is more disturbed by her sunk dad, a manic, depressive widower who threatens suicide via cassette tape. A man is seduced by a woman who's turned on by a mountain lion, but the lion turns out to have been tamed by a meth town breeder, and the woman wants to be hunted because she's into rape role play. The residents of a small town have disappeared, but that mystery is overshadowed by a man mutilating a dead elephant with a peach knife and an old saw, a pick, and his bare hands, only to abandon the taller-than-a-circus-tent carcass to be eaten by maggots. Loneliness permeates the book. In one basement, a man spends his life building a train set but has no one to inherit it. In another basement, a man hoards food and makes plans for a revolution that will never come. In a meditation loft, a mother hides from her husband and son. Fractured families try to find a heart in their homes. And the next shortlist theme is, and there's only one in this one, it's called First Novels. That's the theme, and the reviewer is Jan Stewart. The name of the book is Haunting Paris by Mamta Chaudhry. 278 pages, published by Nan A. Telez Doubleday, $25.95. Chaudhry's elegantly wrought city portrait casts a mournful backward glance at an epochal moment in the history of Paris from the vantage of the 1989 bicentennial of the French Revolution. Liberté, égalité, fraternité seem very much in the eye of the beholder. For many of the primary characters who, residents and foreigners alike, have inhabited Paris like outsiders peering in. Julien, a prominent recently deceased psychiatrist who lost his sister at Auschwitz, was beaten half-blind as a child for being Jewish. His second wife, Sylvie, a piano teacher, feels ill at ease among the bourgeoisie she has married into, and Sylvie's American tenant, Will, longs to penetrate the insular world of native Parisians. Chaudhry's narrative alternates between the grieving Sylvie's attempts to unravel a mystery related to Julien's dead sister and the musings of Julien's time-traveling ghost, who shadows Sylvie while reflecting upon the nettlesome relationship between Paris's ruling classes and its disfavored citizens. The author's ardor for Paris is evident in her copious historical filigrees, which often betray a determination to pack in every last nugget of research, while a society dinner party elicits the bite and atmosphere of the vaunted French novelist treasured by Sylvie. Julien's sepulchral ruminations have the air of a hectoring museum docent with a very circumscribed axe to grind. One wishes Julien could occasionally shift his spectral gaze forward in time to herald the generation of the shunned and persecuted now pressing across France's borders. And the next theme in the shortlist is titled The Royal Affairs by Emma McAlavey. She's the reviewer of the three novels in this theme. And the first one is titled, the first book is titled, Behind the Throne, A Domestic Story of the British Royal Household, by Adrian Tenniswood, 402 pages, published by Basic Books, $32. Britain's modern-day royal household appears to run like a well-oiled machine. It has its own human resources department, and employment comes with a standard package of benefits, but it was not always so. In this domestic history of five centuries of palace life, Tenniswood paints a picture of barely controlled chaos. It is a flattering history of British royalty. If a flattering history of British royalty exists, this isn't it, perhaps because no one looks good through the eyes of servants. Sovereigns, courtiers, and unruly royal children are cast in unforgiving light as Tenniswood, in some cases quite literally, airs their dirty laundry. While a few sympathetic characters emerge, for the most part, members of the royal family appear variously insane, opportunistic, petulant, and mercurial. Pulled from ledgers, maps, and other correspondence, this is a chronicle of beleaguered officials' attempts to impose some structure and economy on the royal household. The subjects are equerries and clerks, courtiers and grooms of the stool, an office that in its original incarnation was responsible for keeping the sovereign company during his or her bowel movements. A good portion of the people employed by the royals appear to have been freeloaders. Tenniswood is constrained by the source materials available to him, which at times can make for dry reading. This is a history of stuff as much as people, especially in the early years of food, jewels, robes, tapestries, renovations. Procuring, managing, and distributing the gold goods, the royal household needs seem to have the job of maintaining the crown. However, the author displays a knack for uncovering the absurd and delightful. A wit born of a deep intimacy with his subject shows through. It has all the effect of bringing the monarchy down to earth. Behind the somewhat surreal pomp and pageant, Tenniswood reveals the all-too-human reality of royalty. And the second one in the Royal Affairs theme is titled The Raven Master, My Life with the Ravens at the Tower of London by Christopher Scaife. 241 pages, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, $26. Legend has it that if the ravens of the Tower of London ever leave, the kingdom will fall. Hence the need for a raven master, and that's where Scaife comes in. In this memoir, he dives into the day-to-day minutiae of the birds caring and keeping, their habits and history, and the journey that led him to become their steward. As Raven Master, a post he took up after more than two decades of military service, Scaife is responsible for more than just the birds. He serves as a tour guide, a ceremonial guard, and an amateur historian, bridging the distance between Britain's past and present. An earnest and exuberant custodian, he's enthralled by the mythologies of the ravens and the storied, haunted tower they inhabit. His esoteric topic at times clashes with the clunky colloquialism Scaife deploys when talking about himself. He identifies with the birds, drawing parallels between his identity as a soldier and the symbolism of the ravens, since both are associated with death. But to his readers, the connection can feel like a bit of a stretch. Personally, meaningful, but not particularly effective on the page. Thankfully, the awkward analyzing is soon forgotten as Scaife plumbs the depths of his knowledge of raven lore, of their place in history and in literature, and he becomes more poetic in his recollections of his life as he shares memories from his time in the military and his love for his wife. Ultimately, Scaife's enthusiasm is contagious. He is entirely likable, and even if the raison d'etre for his memoir isn't immediately clear, the corner of British history that he lives, breathes, and embodies is illuminated by his efforts. This is all the time I have for this week. I will be back next week with the New York Times Book Review. This is Roz Friedman signing off.